Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Fearless Paranoia podcast, where we are busy demystifying the complex world of cybersecurity. I am Brian, the cybersecurity attorney.
And I'm Ryan, the cybersecurity architect.
Today, we're going to return to the subject of multi-factor authentication. If you've been listening to any of our episodes on the various ways you can improve your cybersecurity, you will hear in pretty much all of them some level of multi-factor. Turn on multi-factor. Make sure you have multi-factor enabled. You need to use the multi-factor that comes with all of the software. Everyone has it now. It's an essential tool to improve your cybersecurity. Now, one of the kind of tricky things, though, about cybersecurity tools is that a lot of people think once you've implemented a new cybersecurity tool or practice or method, that somehow it is a panacea. Somehow it is going to resolve all of your problems. It's going to make your entire world better permanently. That's actually probably one of the biggest battles that I have dealing with a lot of my clients who are small businesses and law firms, because they like to look at a problem, they take it head on, and then they want it resolved. So when you inform them that you have found a way to improve their security and you implement it, they expect that the security is improved and they don't even plan for basic entropy. You know, this basic idea that things decay over time. So it is important that when you think about these cybersecurity measures, including multi-factor authentication, you realize and understand that they are never going to be a perfect solve. And I do actually think, unlike most cybersecurity solutions, multi-factor authentication has too often been spoke of in a manner that conveys almost godlike powers. People have talked about multi-factor authentication as though it will solve all of your problems. And I think that is something that really needs to be addressed. Ryan, has that kind of been your, I know you don't speak of MFA in that rarefied air, but has that kind of been at least your feeling in the way that's been pitched?
Yeah, I think so. I think that people, oversimplify the needs for security at some point in time, usually just to drive ease of use or better user experience. But I think that MFA is looked at as, kind of like you said, the key to good security. Anyone that's deeper in the field knows that just like any other security mechanism, it's just one of many layers of security that's really practiced to cover especially the identity space. But while MFA does go a long way to securing user access to accounts, as we found with every other major security tool that's come out over the course of so many years, eventually people find a way to get around it. And so it's important to not just embrace the concept of MFA as it exists now, but to continue to stick with the maturity of the MFA model as it moves forward, so that as those weaker methods continue to get weaker and more easily exploited, you stay ahead of the curve with whatever the kind of current best practice and current accepted strongest mechanisms are that are available.
You just mentioned something right there that I think is really crucial to understand. And it's this idea that multi-factor authentication is not a monolithic thing. It's not a one size fits all or one size equals another size kind of a process. It is, just like any other security measure, something that has weaker and stronger versions of itself. Talk to us a little bit about what it means for MFA to be weaker or stronger.
Sure. So MFA, when it kind of first came to, was, very strict to its definition. It was a second or an additional factor of authentication. So the three core kind of factors of authentication were something you know, which has always been historically your username password combo. So stepping into the multi-factor or the second factor, you start to look for things you have or things you are the two other keys. While biometrics is still, it's gotten a lot better over years, but while that's been kind of the considered one of the potentially more secure methods, because it's a lot harder to recreate or harder to influence, at least until now with AI coming out, I think that what you have has kind of typically been highly regarded as the most common second factor or multi-factor method. And in that case, there's a variety of different things that you can use as tools for the what you have. So you wanted to talk about what's weaker versus what's stronger. Weaker methods would be some of the more traditionally accepted ones, like receiving a voice call on a phone that you've got as trusted, or receiving a text message or an SMS code on a phone that you've got that's trusted. Again, as long as the phone remains in your possession and the phone is secure, those methods are relatively secure. But if the phone gets compromised, or if the service to the phone gets compromised in some fashion through SIM swap, etc., those particular methods could become compromised at the same point in time. So if the first factor becomes compromised and then somebody gets your phone or somebody is able to gain access to your mobile account, in essence, they would very quickly be able to satisfy both factors of authentication.
In fact, isn't it true that basically one of the primary reasons why hackers use SIM swapping at all is to basically take over whatever your second factor of authentication was, assuming that it was a text message?
Yeah, and in most cases, getting access to somebody's phone through SIM swapping, very infrequently are you ever going to get access to somebody's phone just to like make calls on it. That's just, it's kind of silly at its core. It provides a lot of risk with very little benefit.
I mean, unless there are very specific use cases I could think of, like cyber stalking or something like that.
Revenge, those type of means. But like that tends to be a very personal level crime. And those are pretty rare use cases in the greater kind of SIM swapping story. More commonly, it's an attempt to breach the second factor of authentication as it exists on the phone. And since, again, SMS was probably the most common method of second factor, that became the most attacked method by threat actors trying to get ways around multi-factor.
You're listening to the Fearless Paranoia Podcast. For more information on keeping yourself, your family, and your company protected against cyber threats, check out the Resilience Cybersecurity and Data Privacy blog. If you're enjoying this podcast, please like and subscribe using any of your favorite podcast platforms. Also, please share this podcast with anyone you think would find it helpful or useful. We rely on listeners like you to help get the word out about this show, and we appreciate the support. Now, time for some more cybersecurity. Well, and one interesting thing I wanted to bring up, and of course, it's the topic of today's podcast episode, is phishing-resistant multi-factor authentication. This actually happened to me 7 or 8 years ago when I received a call, a very convincing call, from someone claiming to be Verizon customer service. Now, one of the things that sort of tipped me off as someone who does cybersecurity work right away was when they pointed out that the phone number that appeared on my phone should have said Verizon customer service. Well, it didn't, but it was the phone number for Verizon customer service. Now, to me, immediately, I'm thinking there's no way Verizon customer service is going to be trying to convince me that they're who they say they are based on the phone number that comes up on my phone. So that was a pretty big hint. Then they also started talking about how at the time, Verizon was busy building 5G towers in my area. Knowing very well what the status of 5G construction at the time was, I knew there was no way in hell that that was true. But I decided to go ahead and keep talking. I was on the phone with this person for almost an hour, at the end of which my phone received a text message with a password change request. I immediately told him that it turns out Verizon isn't building out its 5G network anywhere at this point in time. So who was he again? At which point he hung up. But I'll tell you, I was actually, quite frankly, and this sounds really weird thinking about it, wildly impressed at how persuasive this person was and how legit he sounded. And what he was trying to do was trying to exploit, without even having access to my phone, that second level of authentication through a basic phishing call. So what types of MFA are we talking about when we talk about the kinds of security that is not phishing resistant? Like what are the kinds of MFA are vulnerable to this type of thing?
So the main types that are vulnerable will be the couple ones that we've talked about already, which would be SMS and voice call. SMS and voice call, first of all, can both be intercepted through a SIM swap because, again, you would be redirecting the typical traffic heading to the phone to a different device under the control of the threat actor. And in some cases, it's relatively easy, even if you get, say, a bad app installed on a device, something to that nature, to be able to potentially go in and intercept, you know, a text message, intercept a phone call. And so those methods tend to not be considered phishing resistant. Next up, kind of on the next chain higher, is moving towards app-based authentication. And even though it's not considered to be phishing resistant in its nature, it's one step towards it. And that's app-based authentication with push notification without any sort of secondary verification. So the common one nowadays with apps that do push notifications is they have a number verification method that comes along with it. So using it without that could, in essence, be considered phishing capable, because to some extent you could annoy a user long enough where eventually they will just click OK or click accept or click allow.
And that's one of the classic examples, right, where a manager at some business receives a notification that someone is requesting access to something, and their responsibility is to be that second factor of authentication, and they just simply get hounded and hounded and hounded until they just click approve, right?
And that's exactly it. And then they just click approve, which at which case that means that the first factor was likely satisfied during the course of the request, the second factor being satisfied just by the nature of clicking that quick approve and being done with it. And that will allow an attacker to sneak in past that slightly more complex and better authentication means. So then we get towards a slightly stronger set still, not truly phishing resistant, but we start to deal with things like one-time password, the six-digit code that you would get from an authenticator app, push notification with the number matching, which provides a secondary layer onto that to avoid that just kind of click approve, because now it's an application on the other end that needs a number entered in once you click approve, and that number is generated on the local phone.
And the idea there is that you'll at least have to put a little more thought into, you're not just clicking approve and you're done with it. You have to click approve and then go into the app and put in the number. And in that period of time, you hope the person responsible will be like, wait a second.
Yeah, but again, still potentially phishing capable, because there's nothing to stop someone from doing what they tried to do with you and being persuasive, right? Now they could ask you for the one-time password from your app. They could ask you for the number that shows up for the number matching when they send the push request through if they're persuasive enough to get it from you. Token-based OTP, so like those old RSA keys that people used to walk around or still do walk around with that have got just like a rotating six-digit code on it. There's nothing to really stop a user from handing over that code if they're persuaded to do so.
Makes me think of the elevator code in Ocean's 11.
Yep. So it's, yeah, so it's still phishing capable for the most part. So to get to true phishing resistant, you have to get away from that necessity of something that the user interacts with as far as like a code that they can hand over to somebody. So that's when you get to the true couple phishing resistant methods. And the two that are broadly accepted by CISA are going to be public key infrastructure standard, which is using something like controlled access cards, which is basically just a card that has like a FIDO capable code on it, or some sort of certificate based authentication, like being able to store a local certificate issued by a certificate authority that's used as the double check. So nothing that a user can just kind of hand over. The other one being FIDO supported hardware tokens or hardware keys. So most commonly things like a YubiKey or something along those lines, because that requires a PIN to secure the key itself. So you'd have to know the PIN. So even if you get a hold of somebody's key, you can't just use it. You'd need to know the PIN. And then you also have to physically have the key. So you'd actually have to physically be able to tap the key. So even if somebody got, say, control of a system where the key was left plugged in, and they have the ability to trigger the key by entering in like username, password, trigger the key, had screen control, and were able to enter in the PIN, they still wouldn't physically be able to tap the key to activate it. So by having those couple extra methods there, it really prevents somebody from, you know, being able to just be actively phished using those methods.
So I think that what this really comes down to is it circumvents or really kind of prevents the person responsible for entering that second factor, whether it's an individual plugging an authenticator from their own phone or a manager who is supposed to approve access requests, anything like that. It prevents the inadvertent or negligent, I will say, handing over of essential access information, because it takes that person's laziness or overwhelmingly busy schedule or vulnerability to being pestered or vulnerability to being conned out of the equation, at least from a remote perspective. If you're standing next to somebody, you can still get them to enter everything that is needed into a computer, just like you would in any other case. But it being phishing resistant means they're not going to be able to do it from Russia.
Yep. Exactly. I mean, it comes down to the whole, I saw a joke once about, it was the NSA and the CIA both trying to crack into a computer, and the NSA said, oh, hey, look, it's using 4096 encryption, and they're like, dang, our plot has been foiled, and they just kind of gave up, and it was the CIA saying, oh, look, this machine has 4096-bit encryption, and they said, here, hit them with this $5 lead pipe till they give us the password. And, you know, so, I mean, there's always going to be ways to get around that type of MFA. But, like, if you're in person, that's a whole different layer of security. You've already breached physical security. There's not a whole lot that phishing resistance is going to be able to help you with. But to what you pointed out there, there's a lot more criminal activity on the internet now occurring behind the anonymity wall from long distances outside of extradition. And this is exactly the kind of mechanism that really helps prevent against those kind of really remote threats.
So now that we've discussed kind of what phishing resistance means when we're talking about multi-factor authentication, and now that we especially have labeled certain methods as being weaker and stronger than other methods, I'm going to circle back to one question that I've had for a while now. Well, two, really. One, when exactly the term circle back entered my vocabulary and why I can't just delete that day from my memory. But two is, every single bank or credit card processor that I know of relies exclusively on SMS-based multi-factor authentication. What the hell?
Well, a lot of it comes down to a couple things. First of all, user behavior is a big one. In order to transition users to something like a phishing-resistant MFA, you have to have the user ready to do that and ready to accept that. So your average user would have to get a hold of a hardware token or something else that's like FIDO capable. The chances of that happening through broad adoption are probably relatively minimal anytime in the real near future. So those institutions are doing the best they can, which voice call and SMS is better than nothing.
Yeah, is it the best they can, or is it just the most they have to do?
Well, it is going to be the bare minimum. There's a lot of them now that are starting to put biometric capabilities into some of their mobile apps, but that doesn't necessarily protect you from logging in, say, from a laptop, desktop, from your computer. A lot of times that's going to be back to just SMS again. There's some banks that are starting to do a little better now where logging into their web portal, they'll give you an opportunity to, say, do your second factor by signing into their application on your mobile device. So it waits for an approved login from an approved device, and then that gives you the ability to do biometric login, do both factors on the device, and then it passes that back as kind of the accepted token for the second factor. That's at least a little better, but yeah, again, it's going to take some user behavior. Of course, they don't want to turn off the user experience or make the user experience too bad, because then you potentially just start losing users.
Well, and what's funny is I can actually see that process you just described where you verify through a mobile app, even though you're using a laptop or a desktop computer. I can actually see a lot of ordinary users viewing that as more risky, just because you sort of, this idea that you're approving access on one device through use of an app on another, I could see them being more paranoid about that.
A rightful paranoia thing, because when you think about it, let's say even if the app doesn't pop up a notification when you are trying to commit that second factor from the website, it just sits there and assumes that at some point you're going to log in, and it's just going to check the login record, right? So let's say somebody gets your first factor. There's nothing to stop them from just keeping a constant login prompt running against your account until at some point you pop open your mobile app and it immediately satisfies the second factor. There would be nothing to prevent that. And unless your app says, oh, hey, by you logging in, thank you, we've passed the login to your browser, you can continue your session there. Unless there's a notification like that that pops up, and most end users would know that, you wouldn't know that there's somebody now that you've just kind of walked right into your account by nature of that method. So it's a better method, but it's not great, and it's still very phishing capable.
You're listening to the Fearless Paranoia Podcast. We're here to help make the complex language of cybersecurity understandable. So if there are topics or issues that you'd like Ryan and I to break down in an episode, send us an email at info@fearlessparanoia.com or reach out to us on Facebook or LinkedIn. For more information about today's episode, be sure to check out fearlessparanoia.com, where you'll find a full transcript as well as links to helpful resources and any research and reports discussed during the episode. While you're there, check out our other posts and podcasts as well as additional helpful resources for learning about cybersecurity. Now, back to the show. Our interest in becoming more mobile with our computing and with all of the information, increasingly needing to carry more and more information in our phones, it not only makes all the multi-factor methods more difficult, it makes the best multi-factor methods perpetually out of reach, or at least out of reach for the majority of users.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see whether one of two things happens. Either we get to a point where the average user starts to adopt more phishing-resistant thing, where everybody just starts carrying some sort of physical hardware, you know, and that's just kind of like carrying your ID around with you or something to that effect. Or whether people just kind of give up trying to stay ahead of that race and just play the game of waiting to see if and when anything happens to them and hope that they just aren't the kind of put your head in the ground like an ostrich method and just hope that hope that you stay safe.
It does, even as a cybersecurity attorney, it really is appealing sometimes to just, you know, the idea of just burying my head in the sand and pretending for a week that the world isn't how it is.
I think it's gonna come down to how much cyber threats end up costing businesses. I think to some extent, businesses are going to have to make an important decision. They're either going to have to start enforcing stronger methods, which means potentially degrading the user experience to some extent, or inconveniencing users and forcing them to kind of bump up their need for stronger security. Or they're going to have to stop accepting liability for covering the costs of user-level breaches, and they're going to have to build that in. So if they can prove that somehow your two-factor was in place, and then a bunch of money was transferred out of your account because the second factor was satisfied and that allowed access, they're going to start writing clauses and things into not have to cover these type of events and activities, which...
It's going to be the security version of the chip and pin card. Because most people, I don't think, actually know what happened when we went from the swipe your card to the chip and pin as the preferred method of payment, and how your vulnerability changed financially if someone managed to secure that card. Stores are no longer obligated at the same level to give your money back in the cases of fraud and theft. So it'll be interesting to see, yeah, how this keeps developing. There will always be people trying to keep the user experience good, but I feel fairly confident in saying that if it costs more money, the user experience will always come second to corporate profits.
Yeah, I think that's usually a pretty safe guess.
Well, this is important information for everybody. And the real lesson here is that you always need to employ the strongest version of whatever security you have within your means and within the reasonable uses that you have. Ryan, what would you recommend as far as multi-factor authentication, be it phishing-resistant multi-factor authentication or not, for most users and for most uses? What would you recommend?
Typical recommendation, I love going with hardware tokens. I love YubiKey on any account that will take it, because it is the hardest to phish. It would be the hardest to take over.
And more and more are accepting them now, thank goodness.
Yep, absolutely. It's referred to as the FIDO or the FIDO2 protocol. So anything that accepts that, I usually do that first and foremost. But the experience is really pretty good with the YubiKey, so I really like that. Let's assume that that's not available, or that's not something the user is willing to go down, because again, a FIDO key is usually $50 to $75 US dollars, so they're not necessarily cheap either, but pay for that level of security. At least it's a one-time cost. Authenticator app to me would be the next one. I usually tell people, unless it's got a number matching backup, to stay away from push notifications. Mm-hmm. Usually you don't get most of them that offer push notifications unless they're offering to a service that they own. So like Duo, if you're logging into a Duo account somewhere, it'll offer it. Microsoft Authenticator will offer it, but only for the Microsoft accounts that are pushed through their authenticator, etc. I usually stick away from that anyways. I would just recommend using the one-time password, so the six-digit code or whatever the rotating code is that they use, as the next backup. And then if you can, for mobile devices, biometrics is not a terrible option. It's better than SMS. It's better than phone call. It's better than an email code. Anything of that nature. So those would be the ones kind of in degrading order that I would go through.
Excellent. Well, that's all the time we have this week on Fearless Paranoia. We hope you've enjoyed the episode and found it informative. Definitely gotten some great advice from Ryan on this one. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do share us on social media. Let everyone know the valuable information that you were able to get out of this particular episode or any of the other episodes we've had. And please reach out to us on social media. It's probably easiest to reach us on LinkedIn or Facebook. If you have any ideas for things you want to hear more about, or just, you know, want to tell us how well or how poorly we're doing on this whole goal of ours of demystifying the complex world of cybersecurity. Look forward to seeing you again in the near future, where we go through a few burning issues on ransomware that Ryan has had in the back of his mind ever since our last episode. So on behalf of Fearless Paranoia, I am Brian.
And I'm Ryan.
Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.